Welcome back, everybody, to the Classic Rock Podcast. And in this edition, we are going back to the dawn of the era that gave us the new wave of British heavy metal. Were you there? Do you remember watching when punk was just fizzling out at the back end of the 70s and a new era that was being ushered in? We saw the beginnings not only of new music, but we had new press as well. How many of you remember buying the very first edition of Kerrang! Magazine? Angus Young on the front. What were you listening to? Well, TV on the radio, Tommy Vance, every Friday night with the Friday Rock Show. And of course, this was the era that saw the beginning of the Monsters of Rock Festival at Donington. And how I bet you wish you could all go back there and experience it all again. And what about the bands? Well, Raven, Iron Maiden, Tigers of Pantang, Girl School, Angel Witch. The list just goes on and on and on. But I did leave out one on purpose. Saxon, because they are the subject of the show today. And normally, we feature a few bands, few interviews, etc. But in this edition, we simply didn't have any time left. Graham Oliver and I, he that is the founder member of Saxon, of course, sat down to have a chat about how it all began, how his interest in music came around, and the glory years at the end of the 70s and through the 1980s. Not only that, but there is new product to talk about as well. Screaming Eagles is a 6-CD box set, which has been released in the last few weeks by Cherry Red, which also, amongst all the other Saxon-related stuff that's in it, includes an album that might have slipped past you. It was called Motorbiker from 2012, which is a real slab of prime British heavy metal. You'll love it. Sounds like early Saxon. And basically, after we got through all of that, we didn't have any time for anything else. We were only scheduled to sit and talk for about 20 minutes. An hour later, we were still going. And so I just thought, well, there are so many great memories and stories here that I keep a lot in here. And so that's what you've got. And just a quick reminder, if you've missed any of the recent shows we've done over the last 3 or 4 months, then you can catch up with everything over at the website. All 83 editions, they're all there, including John Karabi, who was the most recent guest. He's back out on tour with the Dead Daisies, and they're sounding fantastic. You might well have seen any number of videos posted on Instagram and Facebook. Glenn Hughes, too, who is currently out on tour around the US with his Burn at 50 tour plus. We had Susie Quattro, The Damn Truth, Robert John and The Wreck. Loads of great guests telling lots of very good stories and playing very good music in the process as well. All of those actually are going to be on tour in the UK. They're currently all over in the US out on tour, and they'll all be over here, including Susie Quattro, The Damn Truth, who have got a headline tour of their own, as well as going to be appearing with Glenn Hughes, The Dead Daisies next year for them, Robert John and The Wreck in September. Now, this, of course, is rock music very much in the classic vein. What does the future hold? Now, here is something very new which you might like to investigate further. I did. Roadhounds. It's a great name for a band, that, isn't it, Roadhounds? But it is not a band. What is it? Well, it is a new social platform which has been put together by rock music fans and people who've been involved in the industry for years. And it's actually a virtual world where you can pick your own rock-based avatar and explore various rock-orientated zones to discover dozens of new bands and emerging talent. There's all sorts of stuff here, video interviews with bands, and this is of all ages, not just the new icons and new talent combined. There are some live performance clips and mini in-zone quests to complete. And these guys actually put money behind the talent. And how it works is quite simple, because when you listen to a new band on one of their world listening pods, you get a chance to vote. And if a band gets enough votes, then the investment team swing into action. So far, they've actually supported the recording of an album, several national tours, and the production of videos as well. So go online, take a look, actually. You never know, you might just actually be looking at the next big thing here. But at the very least, actually, you'll just meet a load of people that love the music from all over the world. www.roadhands.io, that is the place to go and take a look. Who knows, might bump into you. But let's get back to what we're here for. Graham Oliver is one of the founding members of Saxon. We met recently to talk about his life in music, the birth of Saxon, and those glory days of the end of the 70s and through the 80s and all those fabulous albums. And also Screaming Eagles, which is the 6-CD box set that he has put together. And to take us there, let's get a bit of classic Saxon.
Yeah.
You've seen a lot of change, haven't you, in the 50 plus years you've been producing and playing music. That musical landscape in 1970, when you started touring with Blue Condition, very different from 9 years later when Saxon burst onto the scene. So what do you remember about those very early days hitting the stage?
I remember me and Steve Dawson in Blue Condition having a dream, and we played pubs for 10 shillings, which is 50 pence.
That was before decimalisation then, so it literally was
absolutely
10 shillings.
Yeah. And we had a little J4, a J2 van, or a J4. It was a little van that we trundled around in, and we just did local pubs. And we didn't even have a telephone in them days, and the agent used to send us the gigs a postcard every week.
That's absolutely fantastic. You imagine sitting there waiting for the postman. It's like waiting for your birthday cards to come through the door.
Yeah. So they called him Robin Aldridge. I can even remember him.
Brilliant.
The agent from Doncaster.
So you grew up in the 60s, which was a great time. I mean, there were so many great artists and bands around. And do you remember that moment you stood on stage for the first time with a guitar when you were 10? Playing the Shadows'
yes,
Wonderful
was,
Land.
It were at Doncaster Road School at Mexborough. And it was an half attempt. In fact, my granddaughter goes there now. And my children went to that school. So I've always been back to that school over the years and seen the stage, the first stage I ever stood on. You're correct. I was 10 years old.
Brilliant. And like so many people as well, whose lives were literally changed, weren't they, with a piece of music they heard. You seeing Jimi Hendrix on Top of the Pops doing Are You Experienced, and you're straight out the door to go and buy the album. And I saw a great story of you saying, look, I was so overcome, and I was taking this album to parties and putting it on, and I couldn't understand why other people weren't going as crazy as I was.
Yeah, when the intro to Foxy Lady started with the feedback, then into that F-sharp demonic riff, I couldn't understand why the people weren't jumping up and down, but they were all into soul music. I was standing alone, to be honest. But the first guitarist I saw that turned me on to guitar was Steve Winwood in 66. And he was playing a white Stratocaster, and he did Stevie's Blues, which is remarkably like Hendrix's Red House. And that was my initiation to the blues, and that a guitar could be something other than just an instrument to play songs, like when I saw the Rolling Stones when I was 11. I mean, I saw the Stones at Sheffield City Hall in 64. I was 11 years old. My big brother Brian took me, and the only thing I can remember is Brian Jones in a white suit and girls screaming. It was amazing, really, when I think back. And the fact that I'm 71 and they're still going is even more amazing.
I love it. You teamed up with Steve Dawson, and you used to hang out, and these again are great stories, hanging out in the pubs around Sheffield. There was one in particular, wasn't it, called the Black Swan on Sunday nights. Sunday nights were live band nights, and you'd see everybody at this boozer from Quo, Glenn Hughes and Trapeze, Stan Webb and Chicken Shack.
And Ollie Alsell and Pato. Ollie Alsell, the famed guitarist.
Yeah.
Yeah, we I can remember Status Quo and all them bands. Even Trapeze were great in those days. Like you said, with Glenn Hughes and Mel Galley.
It seems difficult to imagine, doesn't it, now, if you're telling these stories to, I don't know, young kids or teenagers, or people in their 20s and 30s even, but, you know, you could go down to a pub on a Sunday night and see a great band. I mean, and literally pay nothing to get in to go and see them. And these things simply don't happen anymore.
No, it was 50 pence to go in Black Swan.
I love it, 50p. So you had there were two bands in the locale around with you. There was you and this band called Coast with this guy called Peter Byford and Stephen Quinn.
That's correct. Paul Quinn.
Paul Quinn, sorry. And you changed your name. So Blue Condition were gone. It was SOB.
We changed it to Sob.
So
we changed it after the Tons of Sobs album, yeah, by Free. Because me and Steve followed Free around in 1970, sleeping rough and watching him every night. And what's amazing is Andy Fraser was the same age as me. And years later, I met him in Germany, in Cologne. We did a TV show together. And I told him this story. And he were amazed, because I said I would never have been as mature as he were at that age, 17. And he knew 747, which blew me away.
Brilliant. You lost your vocalist then, didn't you, Steve Firth?
Steve Firth.
And yeah, there was the coming together of the bands, and this is what was born was Son of a Bitch, which was a brave title.
Well, what happened is Coast lost their drummer. And so we had a meeting. We bumped into them at the motorway services at Woolley Edge near Barnsley. And we had a chat, and Biff gave Steve a demo, a song called Lady. And Biff wasn't singing, they were playing bass at that point, but he'd done the vocals on this demo. And because they were going to join John Verity Band. Coast until John Verity joined Argent, and that fizzled out. So they were at a loose end pot, and Biff said we only wanted Biff to start with, Steve thought he'd be a great singer. So it's down to Steve Dawson that Biff's a vocalist at all, because he saw the potential in him. And Biff said he'll join if he brings along Paul Quinn. And I'd seen Paul Quinn in Mighty Mouth many times in the pub bands round Doncaster playing brilliant Wishbone Ash covers. He was a gifted guitarist back then. And we joined up and we did gigs as Sob. And we did a gig in London, not the Music Machine, another pub on the... It was like the Fulham Ground, but it was on a very busy junction. The name eludes me at the moment, but listeners will probably be able to remember it. Because and Alan Bowne was in there, of the Alan Bowne set, and he said, you didn't want to be called Sob, all these punk bands, you want something nasty, you want to be called Son of a Bitch. And so it was Alan Bowne who was in a band, he's a famous trumpeter, the Alan Bowne set.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's the one that prompted the name to Son of a Bitch, which I must admit my mother hated.
you mentioned there at the beginning of that story how you met some of the guys you were in a motorway service station coming back for a gig. There was this big community of bands and artists that were literally travelling up and down the country and crisscrossing the various motorways. Did you used to bump into lots of bands, like 11, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning when they're all coming back from different gigs? And you'd say, yes. Oh, look, there's Jagger's just coming back here from Manchester. And there's The Who.
The one that comes to mind is Ginger Baker's Air Force. We went to the services near Sheffield, and we'd done a local gig, so it were nuts that we were going to services, but it was the thing to do because all the bands went to meet up and exchange stories and what guitars they'd bought. It was like a meeting point, because there was no internet, obviously, and nobody had telephones. So that's how we used to communicate and get streetwise what were happening, which bands were up and coming, who were doing the business. And all of a sudden, we were sat there and Ginger Baker walked in, and then Steve Winwood walked in, then Graham Bond walked in, and after the move walked in, and they were all pulling up in car park and getting out, and they'd played at Leeds University, Ginger Baker's Air Force. And this guy said, I also remember, he said, who's that? Why are they all trying to get his autograph? He says, that's Ginger Baker, a world-famous drummer. He goes, drumming my ass. And then they ended up fighting, these two people, right? Really At the Hammer and Tongs.
Love it. Now, yeah, the change of the name, it was Freddie Cannon, wasn't it, at Carrera, who basically just said, listen, guys, unless you change this name, you aren't going to get any airplay whatsoever.
Absolutely. Freddie Cannon, we were selling gigs out by this point in around Newcastle, because in Newcastle in South Wales, there were tons of working men's clubs that were struggling financially. And so they started to have rock nights. And what they'd do is on rock nights, they'd dispense with the committee. So anything went, really. And so we were playing up Newcastle and we'd sold out the Sunderland Boilermakers. In fact, we got that big in these working men's clubs that if you weren't in for 6:30, it was just complete sellout. Doors would be shut. And we did the gig and we went back to the hotel at the railway station. I forget the name, but it's right at Newcastle railway station. And Freddie Cannon had come up from London. He booked a room. Us lot were driving home at 3:00 in the morning back to South Yorkshire. He got a lovely comfy room to go to. But we hammered it out because he got a distribution deal, excuse me, in USA, and obviously they wouldn't have Son of a Beach because it's a really bad thing over there. And so we didn't leave we had coffee and sandwiches till 3 a.m, till we came up with Saxon. And originally it was going to be Anglo-Saxon, but we shortened it to Saxon. But we went through tons of names before, too numerous to mention. In fact, it was a painful, because everything at first sounds silly. I mean, imagine Deep Purple, it's like...
Yeah, you're right.
When you first do them, before they do sound strange. But anyway, we came up with that and stuck with it, and the rest's history, really.
Was there another name that was very close? You got down to, like, two, and it was, well, right, it's either going to be Saxon or it's going to be this.
only Anglo-Saxon or Saxon. That's the two I can remember. All the others I can't remember.
So that... The deal with Carrera, remember it very well because it was the pink or purple record label, wasn't it? And everybody keeps going on or harping on about the fact, oh, it was a Euro disco thing and, you know, completely wrong. But they did have rock artists on that label. I mean, people like Rose Tattoo, Debbie Bonham, Dokken, there was Demon, who you will know.
Demon is still going.
Yeah. They were all on this. It wasn't completely without rock music on there.
No, it was a very mixed label. And that was the strength of the company in Paris. But the only trouble is when they went to America with the distribution, they tried to sell Dollar as well as Rose Tattoo and Saxon. And obviously, the record companies in America that were going to release Wheels of Steel, for example, didn't want Dollar and all these other disco bands, Sheila B. Devotion.
Yeah.
They didn't want them.
I'm amazed you can remember Sheila B. Devotion.
Yeah, and Clout.
Clout.
Oh, did Since You've Been Gone.
Oh, God, yeah, I remember. God, they did that insanely catchy pop song, didn't they, around the time, called Substitute. I'm sure it was them. But that musical landscape that you came through, you're touring in the early days with everybody, including the Clash in the early days.
We did a gig with The Clash.
How did you get on with the, as a heavy metal band in a punk era, how difficult or how easy was it for you to get taken seriously by the audience and to actually create your own audience?
Well, we all, we had the energy of the punks, and the musicianship was a little bit better than most of the punks. And although we looked with long hair, not like punks, because that was... Yeah, I think punk was more of a fashion than anything else. There were a few iconic bands, but the fashion was stronger than, I mean, denim and leather, people wearing leathers and denim, were happening since the 60s right to to now, it's timeless. It's not, you know, to me, it's always been timeless. But we always won them over. I remember playing at the Marquee and Pete Gill knocked a cymbal over, hurting him that hard, and it cut my hand and there was blood all over my white guitar. And I can remember this kid in front row going, "This is fantastic, it's just like punk."
I love it.
But we did tour with the heavy metal kids and they were spitting on us at that time. We got on well with Gary Holton and the heavy metal kids. And that was, they were very punky, yeah.
We'll be right back.
Motorcycle Man, opening chords were inspired by Pretty Vacant.
Yeah, I mean, it were pretty much of a band collaboration. We were collective writing songs at that point. Myself and Paul Quinn came up with riffs. Paul's were more intricate, more busy. Mine were more simple. You can always differentiate between the two. And Paul had got this, no, that's Stallions of the Highway. Yeah. So he'd got that. And he'd got Motorcycle Man. And so we needed an intro. And I started playing God Save the Queen. God Save the... And then it went on into just an A chord, bashing an A. That's the A chord that ended up in Spinal Tap. Because when we did Amethystodium with Motörhead in 79, they'd been testing the dry ice and before doors opened, and we never got to see it. People running in when we were setting our gear up on that tour. And so the roadies had not mopped the stage. And I used to start Motorcycle Man off in the wings, playing that A chord that were inspired by Sex Pistols. Then I'd run into the spotlight, into the middle. I ran into the middle of the stage and my feet went whoop straight on the water, flat on my back. I never stopped playing the A chord, and Rob Price, who was my guitar tech at the time, he ended up going to Iron Maiden for 25 years. He ran on and picked me up and I never missed a beat.
Brilliant.
So that was good how we... to write a simple intro that was just one A chord.
The debut album in 79 got you some really good press, but it was the ensuing years where it all went just completely off the scale. Wheels of Steel, which I keep seeing was nearly called Heavy Metal Thunder, or they wanted it to be called Heavy Metal Thunder, released or recorded in February of 1980, released in the April, and then... The Moment, I suppose, at that time, you know, the record's released. You get on April the 10th, 1980, your first appearance on Top of the Pops. What do you remember? I mean, because this was huge. Getting a heavy metal band on Top of the Pops was still a big news story. So what was the day like for you?
Well, I can remember the album went straight into charts at number 5, which we were all amazed at. And we'd done the Motörhead tour. And Lemmy had been on Top of the Pops. They'd sort of been the first band to do it. And we got the news that Wheels of Steel were in the charts. And we went and recorded Top of the Pops. We actually recorded it with the same time as Judas Priest recorded one of theirs. And Def Leppard, it was on the same stage with the spiral hangings from the ceiling in the same studio. But the week later, it dropped down one point. So they only played it on Top of the Pops if it went up. And so we were all bloody downcast. Then the week later, it started rocketing up charts. And so we were on Top of the Pops, which were fantastic. We ended up doing it 3 times.
Well, you did that one twice because you were on April the 10th and then you were back again. It was 37 in the charts then. And then you were back on May the 1st when you got into the top 20, which is...
That's right.
Which is incredible. And again... For people that don't understand what it was like when there was no internet and anything else, knowing what was in the charts was a question of waiting for somebody to ring you or listening yourself to find out on the chart countdown where you were going to be.
Yeah, we used to listen to the chart countdown on a Sunday night. And it was, you got aware of all the other acts then that were in the charts at the same time. You found out you were competing with all the other pop acts as well as the heavy metal acts. And I can remember doing Top of the Pops one time with Graham Bonney and Motörhead. It was like a real special one. But on one of the Top of the Pops, which is, I live in a small town called Mexborough, Hazel O'Connor used to live there and Tony Capstick used to live there.
Oh.
And on one version of Top of the Pops, there were the three of us all from a little town called Mexborough on Top of the Pops.
That album went gold as well. So you've shifted 100,000 copies of that. I mean, literally, there must be people knocking down the door to get to get in touch with you, to get you on record deals and whatever. And when you look at the amount of work, so you've done Wheels of Steel, that's out April, you're doing tours, and then in the August of the same year, 1980, you're in to record Strong Arm of the Law, which was released at the back end of 1980. So that is two incredible albums released in the same year.
Yeah, well, we had songs left over from Wheels of Steel. After the songs, obviously, because you'd go under 26, 27 minutes a side, unlike today where you can do CDs and do more. But, we were, like I said, a writing collective, and we're all throwing out, there were five of us, all throwing ideas into the middle of the pan. And it was a very productive, creative period, actually. Because when you do the first album, you got the stage act. Wheels of Steel, we got half the stage act as well. But we were writing then, and I can remember everybody just flying by the seat of their pants, putting this idea, that idea. And there were no formulas, no verse, chorus, or beats per minute, or this has to be so long to get radio play. It's just as it came out.
Which is not, I mean, not a question of if a song went over literally three and a half minutes, you'd never get it on the radio. So something like Dallas 1 PM, which was on the, which became one of the staples of the live show and has been for as long as the band's been in existence. I mean, that was a completely different piece of music to anything that you'd done before.
Yes, I mean, well, when we started writing that, Pete Gill used to, we were staying at a farm in Suffolk, and Pete Gill used to get up early and go and practice his drums. He'd be up at 8 o'clock hammering his drums. And then I was always an early riser. So I went in, and Pete Gill were laying this beat down, boom, boom, kak, boom, 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 kak. And I just came up with this riff. It prompted me to go da, 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 da. And then Steve Dawson, he got up, because we all got up at different bloody times at those. And he started laying that A bass, the groove, boom, boom, bam, boom, 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 which you were brilliant at. So Pete Gill and Steve Dawson were real groove masters. And then when Biff and Paul serviced at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Biff came up with the idea of doing a song about Kennedy being shot. And Paul Quinn put the contra melody in that comes in after the riff. Down, 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 down. And then the old band spent the day on it, and we ended up with Dallas. And the arrangement was the toughest, and which is all the band worked on it. And Pete Gill and Steve Dawson used to be the scribers. They'd write down the words and the ideas for lyrics, and then Biff would get the melodies and sing the melodies. But it was very much a collective, and that's how it was done pretty much for all the songs at that period in time.
I did like the story behind Strong Arm of the Law. Was,
oh, that's a true story.
On the number of times you kept getting stopped by the police, the big American muscle car, and you were stopped on London Bridge.
Yeah,
by the police.
Because Margaret Thatcher were driving past. And it was a big...
Did you give her a wave?
Yeah. And all these bunch of scruffy louts in this great huge American car with a V8 rocket engine and old wheel looked pretty dubious. I said, I would imagine, and we all got stopped and searched, and, you know, the only speed we have is our car, is that what one of us said. And that ended up a lyric in the song.
That was, another one of the great stories of the time. I have to say, the record that got me onto it, I remember walking into a record store and seeing the picture sleeve of Wheels of Steel, the single. And, you know, if you didn't listen to the Friday Rock Show, or you missed last week, then the chances of hearing any of this stuff in daytime radio were virtually zero, wasn't it? I mean, airplay was very slow in catching on. I mean, Radio 1, you know, obviously Tommy Vance, you know, John Peel was a bit more punk, but for you to get coverage. But one of the ones I do remember that did get a lot of coverage, a lot of airplay was 747, Strangers in the Night. Is that the quintessential Saxon song? Out of everything that has ever been done, is that the one?
It's the most radio play around the world. And the ice chart success will never surrender. But Ride Like the Wind, Paul Quinn did all the guitars on that.
The other major thing was the touring of the time and the gigs. And you, of course, were on the bill of the very first Monsters of Rock Festival back in 1980. So when you got the call to be involved in that, did you have any idea about what they were doing? Because I remember a lot of people at the time thought it was just a rainbow outdoor gig with some guests.
Yeah. No, we had no idea it would become the iconic festival that it did become. Because I remember doing an interview with Kid Jensen when he was at, Capitol?
Yes.
And because I remember taking your point up about not playing much of our songs on radio, because I can remember one of the artists on tour, B.A. Robertson, had to cancel some of their gigs, and we were following him round, and there were poor ticket sales, and we were selling out everywhere, and they wouldn't even play our stuff on breakfast TV, but they had B.A. Robertson on, and our people got told that our video for Four Wheels of Steel were too violent or something, just some excuse. And I said to Kid Jensen, they ought to play more, because people, he says, yeah, but they said that about George Melly. And I said to him, my response to that was, yeah, but you won't get 50,000 kids camping out in a field to see George Melly. And that's what's happening at Donington this weekend. You know, so
you were the first British band to take the stage at a Monsters of Rock Festival, because they had Riot and Touch on as the opening two. And of course, one of the great stories about that, well, I don't suppose he thought it was great at the day, was when the drummer swallowed the bee.
I weren't aware of it, did I? Yeah, I weren't aware of that.
Oh, it's one of the folklore stories. Was it Doug Howard? The drummer with Touch, actually, they're playing their set, and he picked up a bottle of beer and didn't realise there was a bee in it, and he swigged the lot down, and the thing stung him on the throat, and he had an allergic reaction to it. So he will never, ever forget the first Donington Monsters of Rock festival. Do you remember what your first track was that you played at Donington Park?
Weren't it Motorcycle Man?
Yeah. But it was an epic show, by the way. Yeah. When you look back at the reports.
Well, the dressing rooms were a very long way, a bus ride away, shuttle bus ride away from the stage. So I remember taking the shuttle bus down with Joe Elliott. He was there just as a guest hanging out at the show. And I went down early to see Judas Priest. And when I was walking up to the stage steps to go to see Priest and Scorpions, there was a Mercedes parked outside the tune-up room. And the window wound down. I heard this voice shouting, "Graham, Graham." I turned around, it was Richie Blackmore. And we had a great chat. I didn't even know him from Adam. I'd met him briefly, but when we did the Rainbow shows.
It was Deeside Leisure Centre, wasn't it?
In the early Deeside, yeah. And Bingley Hall at Stafford.
Oh, legendary venue. You had quite a relationship with Rainbow. I mean, they were so impressed with you at Deeside, didn't they? They dropped you off the tour. It was obviously you'd been too good. They couldn't be doing without you there, potentially upsetting the headline act. But he did say to you, didn't he? Oh, it's nothing personal, just management.
He did. When we toured America with Rainbow, he came in his dressing room and he says, "Let me look at your finger." He says, "I never realised you'd had an accident and lost an inch off your main plain hand index finger." And And then he said all that business back in 1980, it was management, it was nothing to do with me. He says, but we dropped Samson as well.
Oh, those were in the days of Bruce Dickinson sort of as well, wasn't they, Samson? Or Bruce, he wasn't called that, yeah, was he? Bruce his name was at the time.
That's what he called himself. Yeah, we did a few gigs with Samson and with Bruce. And Iron Maiden.
Great band, by the way.
Yeah, brilliant. I still miss Paul Samson's phone calls. He'd always phone me up and say, have you forgot how to use this so-and-so telephone? And he used to brag about the rarest Hendrix bootlegs he'd just acquired.
Brilliant. Great. They're great tales. Yeah. And I'm thinking about from those days in September 79, when you played with Iron Maiden at the Music Machine. If you look at, again, and this is as well as the three albums we've got up until the end of 1980, you're playing with Motorhead, Rainbow, Tigers of Pantang, Angel Witch, Girls School, Priest, Scorpions, Sabbath, Ozzy, Cheap Trick, Crocus, Quo, ZZ Top, Jethro Tull. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
AC/DC, I'm Back in Black.
I mean, it's an unbelievable roll call of rock royalty. I mean, did you have any feeling at the time that this is just so amazing, this is so great, life is so good it can't possibly go on forever?
It was fantastic. Yeah, it was just fantastic. I remember Angus being told that Angus had only booked us on USA Back in Black gigs so he could hear 747 live.
It's great.
And when we did Back in Black, Heaven and Hell, Black and Blue tour. All these tours had names, it's hard to remember them all. But Heaven and Hell tour we did, Tony Iommi sat me down in his dressing room and tried all his finger ends on my bad finger. But none of them fitted, unfortunately, because he said I could have one.
You saw.
But yeah,
you saw AC/DC, didn't you, in the very, very early days in the Dirty Deeds tour, I think it was, in Sheffield.
Sheffield, yeah, Steve Dawson and Biff. We all went to see the show, yeah.
Yeah!
And that, of course, was with the great Bon Scott. Incredible. Yeah. And then, so you're doing all these tours, and then, I mean, you find time, what, to get in the studio again? This was, what, released in September of 1981. So if you think Denim and Leather is released in September 81, you've had Denim and Leather, Strong Arm of the Law, and Wheels of Steel all released within 18 months. I mean, there wasn't anybody around at that time. And again, these are going gold, silver. So that's over a quarter of a million copies of these albums shifted. Were you all driving Rolls Royces and living in big houses and drinking Dom Perignon?
Absolutely not. That's another story.
I was going to say, is that
the great rock and roll?
Is this a tale of bad management again? I mean, that we heard so often of those times, you selling out every venue you can think of, selling more records than anybody else, and you're sitting there going, I haven't got enough money for the Tesco Big Shop.
It's something like that. I mean, the thing is, management can be clever sometimes. They pretend, well, it's hard to say, because the guy that managed us, two of the guys that started us off with were really good. And then they introduced a third guy, who I'll not name because he's not here, so he can't defend himself. And he used to manage the Joe Cocker and Mad Dogs and Englishmen and a lot of other things. But he was savvy to offshore companies and doing deals. So he did nothing contractually wrong, but morally. My accountant said years later when he saw the contracts, how could you sign up to that? Because somebody had turned up at the airport and said, you need to sign this publishing deal so I can send your wages home to your wives and you. So they'd use your working class mentality against you. We should be paying them the wages. They should be invoicing us. But it's just a sad tale, really. But years later, you get tied up with merchandise deals and publishing deals, where vast amounts of money is generated on paper and people take commissions. But at the end of the day, the commissions are so great because you can't be a publisher and a manager at the same time. It's a conflict of interest. It doesn't happen these days, but in those days it did. And in a lot of those contracts were for perpetuity.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But on a more positive, line, that album... Again, Denim and Leather produced some of the most enduring classics. I mean, Princess of the Night, a big one. Never Surrender was on there. And again, one of the favourites that got you on Top of the Pops, written about the Donington Festival, of course, was And the Bands Played On.
Yeah. I remember how we wrote that. I got a couple of... I was listening to... Thin Lizzy, Don't Believe a Word, you know, da 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 da. I thought, that's a cool riff. I'd like to do something like that myself. So I came up with the Bands Played On riff. And then we needed a chorus, a verse pattern. So I'd just been listening to Robin Trower and Whiskey Train. And he does a riff called, in a song called Whiskey Train, what goes da 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 da. In A, so I transposed it to E, and I said to Paul Quinn, what do you think to this? And he goes, yeah, and if I do this over the top, he put that melody, contra melody, over the top. And that's how it came together, and me and Quinn had the ideas, and then we took it to the band, and Biff had the idea to do a song about Donington, and they had the melodies. And then Steve Dawson and Pete Gill had ideas. We all arranged it together. So again, that was probably just before we started not writing songs like that anymore as a collective.
You got back to Donington as well. You were the first band to be invited back twice, or first to appear twice.
First band to do it twice, When you meet Metallica, and they were our support band in America, they did... two shows at the Whiskey supporting us, the second ever gigs they ever did. And they always remember us. And they used to talk about they'd Dunnington were like my Woodstock. You know, I were in awe of people who played Woodstock, and they were in awe of people that played first Dunnington. And on Death Magnetic Tour, they still remembered that. And I says, can we have a gig when next time you play Sheffield, me and Steve? And Lars said, oh, you'd have to see it promoted. And it was me and Steve that picked him to play bloody Whiskey A Go-Go, their second ever gig. So even with all their power and their how big they are, they still can't call shots like we could call back in them days and say, yeah, we want Metallica for our support from this bunch of tapes, what's been submitted. It's a radio promotion.
Yeah, you know? yeah, absolutely, which is huge over there, those guys, the A&R guys pushing stuff around. I was talking to the guy that literally discovered Tom Petty and put him on the map after he was being literally rejected by everybody and anybody. And the great, remember John Cougar Mellencamp, whose big yes. stunt at the time was literally taking a cougar on a leash into yeah. radio studios. But your inroads into the US, you know, on the first US tour you did, your first band was Rush, wasn't it, in the Charlotte Coliseum in North Carolina back in September of 1980?
Yes, that was fantastic. That we went from doing a small gig at Retford Porterhouse. And next gig we did was that Coliseum with Rush.
25-odd thousand people.
Yeah, and we did Philadelphia Spectrum. We did all the main venues on the East Coast. And it was scary and exhilarating at the same time because we'd never been in an arena gig. We'd done D-Side Leisure Centre, but there weren't big American cops stood backstage walking about with guns and things.
I know, it's great. A great story. It's nearly as good as the story of you picking up this American journalist, or what you thought was an American journalist, who was just going to follow you around for a few days and just see how things went. And this guy was called Harry Shearer.
Yeah. Actually, that were it. Leicester, it was an English tour where we picked him up. It was an English tour. Yeah. And the first gig was Leicester de Montfort Hall. And our manager, Nigel Thomas, at the time, he'd invested in films like Blade Runner, probably investing our money in him. And he was friends with Ridley Scott. That's how Ridley Scott got to produce the Power and the Glory video. And Nigel came to us and said, we've got a guy who's doing pre-production for a movie, a comedy movie about music, rock music. Can he come on the tour bus for a week? And we said, yeah, of course, no problem. Anyway, he came on tour bus for a week. And he just sat after hours and we just told him stories, like the story I told you earlier about falling over on stage.
Well, that appeared in, as soon as you said it, anybody that's seen the film knows that that appeared in the movie with the, I can't remember who it was, falling over and the tech, and continued to play the guitar, and then his guitar tech coming on behind him and is lifting him up as he's playing still. So that was obviously one of the things that made it in.
Yes. And the other story that made it, and we told him about Ozzy getting lost backstage. And that made it in as well.
That's brilliant. That for those of you that, I can't imagine there's anybody that's likely to be listening to this that has never seen Spinal Tap, but if you haven't, then it's an iconic moment, isn't it? They leave the dressing rooms and it's like, yeah, let's rock. And then they stop and yeah, ask the commissionaire guy, the janitor, which way's the stage? And then four yeah, minutes later, they come back and they've done a full circle.
It were easily done in those American gigs, though, I'm telling you. We got lost many a time because sometimes the dressing rooms would be at the far end from the backstage area through a series of tunnels. So I can see how it happened easily to Ozzy. especially to Ozzy. Who was incidentally our support group through Europe.
Yes, yeah. In the very early days, of course, with his Blizzard of Oz, well, he was trying to, he was coming off the back of Black Sabbath and watching Sabbath, who were doing amazing things with Ronnie James Dio at the correct time. So, moving on to Power and the Glory, this is when we start to see a bit of change, but it's not difficult to see why, because musical tastes change, production techniques change, fans want maybe different things, and so you're getting in outside producers for some of this stuff. And Power and the Glory had one of the big names. You had a guy called Jeff Glicksman in producing, who'd again had a real A-list of clientele.
He was great with guitars. He could get guitars down. And we'd wrote all these songs at a place, an hotel down in, I think it was near Suffolk, near Hastings. UFO used to rehearse there, and what they did is they used to, in this winter time, out of season, they used to hire the rooms out in the ballroom, so for bands to rehearse and write songs. And we'd wrote Power and the Glory, and then went to Atlanta, Georgia, Axis Studios, and that's one of my best riffs. If people ask me which is one of my best riffs, it's Dallas and Power and the Glory. And Jeff Glicksman were great for getting guitars onto tape, you know. I think he'd done Yngwie Malmsteen and lots of people.
Yes, yeah, Kansas, Gary Moore he'd worked with as well.
Yeah, they were really good. And they were good to get along with as well.
And that album really as well, I mean, shifted, what, 1.5 million copies worldwide? I mean, you know, big, big seller.
Yes, it was. I remember on that recording session, we went to see Judas Priest. They were in town at Atlanta, and KK Downing came back to the studio and we played him the whole album after hours, and he says, "You buggers, you've nicked my songs."
Again, following Crusader, I mean, everything's flying along. So, you know, we haven't even got halfway through the decade and you're already onto your fifth album. You know, was there not a point here where anybody was perhaps getting close to burnout, feeling tired, relationships start to get a bit strained through nothing else than the fact that you're all working at such close proximity to each other for such long periods of time? You need a break.
Yes, I suppose that's what happened, really. Because it was like a roller coaster. You just couldn't get off it. It was getting harder and harder to write because you were exhausting your ideas with that many albums and songs. Because first off, you're full of them because you've got a lifetime of songs and ideas and guitar riffs, and then it gets harder and harder. And, I suppose it were, really. I know Biff and Steve, they went off to write together to do Innocence. There's no excuse. They went to Biff's house down near Skegness and wrote songs on their own. And that became part of Innocence. And so that's when, I think, management were saying to people, I think management had liked Biff to be like Ozzy Osbourne, main songwriter with lyrics and not a collective. It was becoming less of a collective and more of people doing things on their own. So I don't know.
Yeah.
That's when it started to not be as successful, I think, anyway.
It wasn't about, again, I mean, Innocence is no excuse. You know, what I was seeing when you look back at the time is maybe the reviews in the English rock press, well, which was basically Kerrang! Magazine, wasn't it? And that was about it. And Sounds was, maybe, were sort of saying, well, this is just getting a bit, I mean, if it had been Def Leppard, it would have been, they've sold out. But the American reviews, which were less complimentary in the beginning, were liking the more commercially polished production that you were beginning to see. So you were getting better reviews over there.
Well, because first off, companies would say in America, it's too British heavy metal. And then we started... What you've got to remember is that things like Motley Crue was just coming out and MTV. Mm. And everything was having to be big business. MTV were getting huge and things getting real airplay and image and everything. And I think we had his own image and we should have stuck to it. But record companies and management tried to make us a bit more pretty boys, which we weren't. We were nasty heavy metal boys from Yorkshire. I can see why they thought that, you know.
And so all that time that you were spending in the States, the growing amount of time that you spent touring over there, etc., how did life in the US suit you? I mean, was it, you know, did you embrace it full on and go, right, this is it, this is where we got to be? Or was there that craving to be back in England? It's nice, but this is like a holiday. We can't wait to get back. I want to get back, you know.
Yeah, I think we wanted to get back. It was nice to tour America, but sometimes we toured with Cheap Trick and Molly Hatchet, and it was wrong audience, to be honest. It was like being in the army, it was very regimented.
We'll be right back. So the 80s produced 10 albums. I mean, 10 albums. I lost count of the number of tours, the singles, the Top of the Pops appearances, the Donington appearances. You were just about one of the hardest working bands out there.
We did seven weeks in Europe at one time.
But did you get the credit? At the end of that decade, when you sit back and you look back at what you did, what you produced, what you achieved, do you get the credit that you deserve, or do you think people were just all too quick to lavish everything on Def Leppard and Iron Maiden? And
well, even Iron Maiden did catchy songs like 2 Minutes to Midnight. They realised that in America you had to have something that sing along, you know. So I just think we were the first out of the three that you mentioned to rate. And I think journalists, the couple of journalists that didn't like us, well, I even know one journalist that reviewed us front bar, never even saw us. So I think we were the first one to be knocked down. And unfortunately, it would have been nicer to have a slower rise than a faster rise. Yeah.
So coming to the present day then, and the reason that, you know, you're back to in the press grind and everything, is a focus on the last 20 years. So we've got the Screaming Eagles, the complete works of not only everything that you did in that 20 years, but also it includes the album Victim in You, which was recorded as Son of a Bitch with Pete Gill. So this is getting a repackaging and being put out there. And maybe some people haven't heard that.
Well, that's a great album. Unfortunately, it came out when Seattle Grunge, it just came out at the wrong time. And a few years later, when these bands came together, like the, what they call them, My Vultures, you know.
Oh, yes, them Crooked Vultures.
Them Crooked Vultures, when these supergroups came together and did albums, it were more of a period when they were acceptable and liked, whereas that Son of a Beach album, it was still Nirvana and all, and things was massive. It's just the wrong time, but I think it's definitely a good album and worth a listen to people who haven't heard it before.
And as well as that, there's It's Alive. And again, another one that may have got overlooked again, or people may not realise that it was out there, was Motorbiker from, 2012?
2013, I think. Yeah, Motorbiker was... you see, we had no record company, so we were doing it all by ourselves. We had to do everything and pay for everything ourselves. If we'd have had record company support, like from SPV or somebody like in Germany, like other people have had, Motorhead, and you could work, you know, have a lot more of a output. But I think to say that our backs were against the wall and the chips were down, we did tread water and sustained ourselves for 20 years, which is fairly good going, I think. Without no financial support whatsoever.
I do remember seeing that second wave of 25 years of new wave of British heavy metal. You did a track for that, didn't you? Nursery Crimes, and you were on there with
we did three.
Oh
tracks.
yeah, you did, didn't you? Broken was one of the other ones. A Ghost.
Yeah, and Ghost. Yeah, they're songs that should see the light of day again. I think I'm not sure what legality is on that, on those songs, but it'd be nice to hear those again.
So things like social media, the internet, the streaming platforms and everything else these days, which are highly prevalent, in some respects you can understand why musicians, you know, getting paid so little are somewhat aggrieved. But again, for stuff like to reintroduce you to some of the classic bands, you might not go out and buy the album, but you're going to go out and listen to all of this old stuff. So it does have its place.
It does. I know you don't get much for streaming, but, I mean, our publishing's healthy, so we're okay. And it's just nice if people had have a listen to Victim, you on Alexa or whatever social media streaming format they use. Listen to Motorbiker. I mean, the song with, I just can't remember, the one with Adolf Hitler at the beginning.
Oh, God.
No Way Out.
Now, that was, let me see, that was my German, Radar Aufstahl, was it?
Radar Aufstahl, yeah. I mean, just check all them tracks out on Alexa. Give them a chance.
The other great really thing about releases like this is the way they're put together. So, you know, you get this great, so this in this case, a 6 CD box set, but inside you've got all the linear notes and you've got pictures and photographs from you guys, your own personal collections and reviews and stuff. And it's a fantastic trip back over the years. It's not just about putting a CD in. It's nice to see work going into the package, the complete package.
Yeah, I've not seen it finished yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. And I hope it does okay. It's a nice collectible thing to have. Because I'm still a CD player. I buy a car with a CD player. I like my CDs and albums. I think everything else is a convenience. And CDs and albums are possessions that you can look and read and look at the pictures.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's good to see so many people doing this, where they go back and put together these deluxe super editions. And, you know, people are realizing now that they've actually got to do a bit of work. It's no use just slinging a few records or CDs in a box and then charging five times the amount. They're now getting more artistic. And you're seeing different content on these things and content that you won't find anywhere else. So what's the future? I mean, I know none of us are getting any younger, so us talking about futures, but...
Well, I've just come back from Japan in June, where we did a fantastic two nights in Tokyo with Paul Quinn on guitar, a special guest, and that were all recorded for posterity. So one day I might be able to do something with that. And we've got a gig in Barnsley at Christmas at Birdwell. And Paul, we're going to do the Tokyo show because we did a special set list for Tokyo. And we're going to do it at Birdwell venue in Barnsley on the 30th of December. But I've just been diagnosed with Parkinson's, sadly. So I'm battling that. So
how do you feel in your? I mean, it's never easy to get a diagnosis.
I was shocked like this. I mean, 76, I cut my finger off and told I'd never play a guitar again. When I was 59, I had a mini stroke, and that paralysed my left side. And I thought I'd never play again. So I've overcome them. So I've got another battle on my hands. So I've done it three times. So it'll be the third time lucky. It's not going to beat me as yet. So I'll just. I'm just going to keep going till I can.
Have you spoken to Ozzy? Because, I mean, obviously he was diagnosed with a variant of, and he's been, well, we know he's been hard at work in various forms of physical therapy, et cetera, but seems to be getting on really well.
Yeah, well, I'm on medication, and I went to Jam Night last week, and I did a gig in Lancaster with Oliver's Army, which is the band that we're using now. And I did really well, because before I had to concentrate on my left hand to make it work properly, whereas it was a lot like all playing things that I hadn't played for a couple of years. Because I've had this complaint since lockdown and thought it was a trapped nerve. I didn't know what to put it down to. I just put it down to inactivity, bitter old age and arthritis or a trapped nerve. So, so it's been slow. Hopefully medication is going to keep it under control.
Good. And lastly then, after 50 odd years in this...
Never surrender.
It's a great, great one. But what is the abiding memory for you? What what is, I mean, it's, I know it's difficult out of everything, but if you, you know, if you had to think of, I don't know, one thing or a song and you just think, yeah, that gave me more pleasure than pretty much anything else.
I did a gig at in Germany, Headbangers, and the whole audience, it was with ODS, with Steve Dawson, and we played a full Saxon set, and the whole audience of thousands sang every word of every song from beginning to end, from the beginning of our set to the end of our set. And I thought, that's an achievement, that, because there was a young girl who travelled all the way from Los Angeles who came for autographs and meet and greet afterwards. And she said, I sung every word, those songs were fantastic. And Tim, she weren't even born then when we did those songs. So it was just a fantastic moment to think that we'd meant so much to so many people, majority of them who weren't even born.
I will say this to conclude. If you do go back and you listen to some of the music around the back end of the 70s, the new wave of British heavy metal and stuff through the 80s, a lot of it has not travelled well. I mean, it sounds of its era, and, you know, you may put it on after you've had a few drinks one night just to remember something. It's not the case with the Saxon albums, any of those albums. Wheels of Steel, Strong Arm, Denim, Power and Glory, Crusader, even the likes of Innocence, Rock the Nations, possibly not Destiny. But, you know, most of these, you go back and they have travelled time extremely well. They still sound as great today as they did then.
That's great to know. That feels really good that you've made a little piece of history and it's going to be there forever, long after we're gone. And I know from my royalty statements that what you've just said is completely true, because the albums I did afterwards, up until 95, don't even figure in the royalty statements. Nobody's listening to them. They're listening to those, the ones that you've just mentioned, which is a fantastic accolade. And just a good feeling that you did something that stood the test of time. I mean, I like to listen to Jimi Hendrix. All on the Watchtower is as fresh to me as it were in 1968. And I'm hoping that's a fantastic thing to have done. And so hopefully that was a little bit same.
You can't.
that, that was Graham Oliver talking to me a few weeks back. And that track of music, incidentally, Motorbiker, came off of the Motorbiker album, which is part of the 6-CD box set called Screaming Eagles, which is available now. Great time we had, actually, sat down just remembering some of the incredible times and the music of the late 70s and the early 80s. And that is it, though, for the show. Don't forget, you can catch up with everything on the website, www.theclassicrockpodcast.com. All of the previous shows, all 83 of them, are on the website. In the meantime, thank you very much for listening, wherever you're listening in the world, and we look forward to having your company again very soon. From me, Tim Cable, till next time. Bye-bye for now.